Welcome back. We're going to continue with our afternoon session on moral decisions, a theosophical approach to everyday ethics. So we've previously looked at the moral principles going on the mental plane that factor into our moral decisions. We've looked at their practical application in our everyday deeds, in the accumulation of wealth, power, abilities, and also how we apply those and disperse those benefits. This afternoon, the first three presentations will then, now we're going to go to the plane of speech. How do we address these moral decisions in the way we express ourselves? Our first presentation asks the soul-searching question, do I always have to tell the truth?
Well, maybe there are some exceptions because we are in the Kali Yuga, you know. We found this great quote to start it off. Truth is the new hate speech. In a time of universal deceit, the truth is a revolutionary act. So we'll start off with talking about lies versus truths on a big level and then get it real practical real quick. There's something we learned that came from the works of Plato called A Noble Lie, and for anybody who's a student of Plato, sorry, I'm kind of going to mess it up, but you're going to get where I'm coming from. And the noble lie is something that it's a device used by the elite or the leadership of a country, a nation, or a city to create a story with ideals that people can aspire to and present it to the people as though this is who we are and this is what we do, with the intention to move in that direction. But it's presented in certain ways factually. So the question then is, you know, is this a lie that we're creating, and are we following, you know, false ideas? Is it the right thing to do? An example of that is Homer with the Iliad and the Odyssey, ancient Greece. Now, we all know that there was Odysseus and Achilles, and they went through all these interesting challenges. And these works were, you know, they were the two works that, or if you consider them one together, that impacted the Western world, the Western thought, more than any other work until the Bible came along. And the thing about the Iliad and the Odyssey, it had all the ethics and the moral teachings. It had all of the truths in it. And when a child would think about a certain situation that he's in and he's heard his grandfather talk to him about what Ulysses did in such a situation, and Ulysses is a hero, so I'm going to be like Ulysses, I'll do what Ulysses did. But the general understanding among the populace eventually was, yes, it is a myth, it is a story, it is used to help people make the right moral choices. So in that sense, the word that Plato used in the Greek, even though academically often it's called the noble lie, it can also be interpreted as the magnificent myth. Now, how could it be a noble lie? The other side of the coin is, you know, we've all heard of the story of St. Paul, who he took the character of Jesus and created the stories of the New Testament and went around and spread them around. And then ancient Rome took it because ancient Rome had acquired so many nations, it was so huge, they needed a common fabric to unite the empire, and they used the stories of the Bible to gain control or to make a fabric for all of these different peoples to pull together. And the problem was the difference between how the people interpreted it, because in ancient Greece it was interpreted as it was. It's a story, it's a myth, and therefore we can see the truth in it. But when with the New Testament, when it came along, the Western mind was on a downward cycle. And so eventually it became not the myth, but history. And by it becoming history, the truth of the stories was lost, and the myth became the truth. So that, in a sense, is the lie. So we have to be careful about that. Now, how would that play out in our lives? Do I always have to tell the truth? Well, some other magnificent myths would be the story of King Arthur, and even ideas that were written at the beginning, early in American culture, with Masonic ideals of what should be taught to the people of America, whether that ever took root, but it was an effort. Well, so this magnificent myth or noble lie, however you're going to view it, on the individual level, can help or hurt. If we tell the truth or if we lie, that can help or hurt us, just like it can help or hurt entire civilizations. For instance, lying requires a lot of mental effort. And one of the problems with lying is, see, if we always tell the truth, then we just have to remember one thing, the truth. But if we lie, then we have to remember which version of the lie that we actually, right? So that's first. But also lies, physically, personally, they cause stress and anxiety. Your cortisol goes up, your norepinephrine goes up, your stress factors like blood sugar and your heart rate and all this. So it's an unhealthy physical thing to do because it's just inconsistent with your true nature, as we were talking about earlier. But on the other hand, the benefits of telling the truth is that generally, no matter what the repercussions, it's less stressful because you know you did the right thing. You save your sanity, you save your physical health. And very often, we win the respect of other people. We are trusted more by other people. And interestingly, doesn't that give us opportunity to be all the better able to help and teach others if others inherently can trust us because they know that we're of the character that we tell the truth. That's the kind of people that we are. So truthful people sleep better, eat healthier, and therefore look better too. Now, one of the things about lying is, every thought, action, and movement and emotion that we have, that every individual has, is impressed upon a tablet within the astral light. And this impression, like any other impression, this impression of thought, it's going to come back to us. So that when the conditions are right for that lie and the effects of that lie to return to us and we're put in similar conditions again, are we going to respond in the same way and lie? Or are we going to say, wait, stop, let's fix this? Because each time we reiterate the lie, it becomes stronger and stronger and more of a challenge to overcome and set right. So karma is intricately connected with telling the truth because it sets us free. We'll talk about that. As opposed to lying. Yes. What's that?
1 minute.
1 minute. Okay. So, all right. Well, in that 1 minute, we'll think about words are alive. Words are ideas, and they are ensouled by sound. And words that we communicate from ourselves, when they leave our mouths, they are... We can consider them as individual entities. So when we speak the truth versus the lie, what's the effect on us having on what effect are we having on life around us?
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, lady in the back, please.
So what about white lies? Isn't there on some level, isn't it appropriate at some point where it's the right thing to do? That's the point. The question is, do I always have to tell the truth? So each can decide for himself. We're no authority. The authority lies within the individual. One great quote that we found, and we couldn't find the author of it, was in terms of white lies, or should I tell the truth, or was it a truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. Yes.
We lectured one of our children very severely about lying, and a few minutes later there was a terrible crash in the living room, and I went in and he looked up at me and he said, "I'm not going to lie, he did it."
We have two dogs, and really, we think they do that to each other, too.
Would you repeat that quote again? I didn't get one of those words.
The truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. Yes?
Is there any difference between the printed word and the spoken word? In other words, say, slander versus libel? Or is it just...
Let me get that straight in the next talk.
Oh, actually, that's coming up on the next talk.
Oh.
We're sticking to the lies. Right?
So we'll stick to the lies. Right?
But that's...
Yes?
Is there truth in every lie, or truth in a lot of lies? Or
Is there truth in a lot of lies? All right, well, let's talk about getting people to believe something because it's what's good for them. Sometimes that's called dogma. One thing about dogma is that there's a level of truth in a story or in a teaching, in a doctrine, but there's a lot of falsity in that doctrine. But it's the truth that people who are, so to speak, ignorant or not as aware, they're attracted to that. So I see something right about it; I must be right. And then the personality of, we'll just say, the priest, can affect people by using these dogmas, which in large part, of course there are great, sincere, educated priests and other religious authorities, but if the idea is false, the idea is false. Now, take that situation. We remember one individual who was being interviewed. His title was the president of the Catholic League, and he's the president of all the Catholic lay people, 80 million in America. He was being interviewed, and he said, as a matter of fact, because he was asked this by the interviewer, "Well, there's no way." Well, his response to a question was, "No, I've never met a priest, a theologian, or a professor in a Catholic university that actually believed everything that they were teaching. But they taught it anyway because that's their duty, that's their job." Okay, now that's their, and yet they're in a position of authority as a professor, as a priest. And now let's contrast that to the truth. Should we always tell the truth? The difference is, as we make the effort, say, to promulgate the teachings of theosophy, first and foremost, how often do we find ourselves saying, "Don't believe everything I'm saying because I'm just doing my best to try to help you get it, but read it, check it for yourself." Woe be it to the student of theosophy who tries to convince someone of a doctrine that he knows is false, but is using his influence on that person for some reason to get them to believe something that's not true. So that's the difference. There's no authority here. Is there truth in some lies? There is, but it's up to the individual to sift through it and separate the wheat from the chaff. Yes?
In a number of theosophical books, The Key to Theosophy, HPD, and others, it's clearly stated that the Bible was purposely written in much allegory and parable form, yet one of the greatest evils that I've seen in the past 2,000 years is that had humanity known of the true words that should have been in the Bible, rather than, or could have seen through that parable and allegory, maybe this past 2,000 years would have went a little bit better. So why hide the real truth so deep and so far that we ended up massacring the last 2,000 years?
Right. So the question is, why so often is the truth hidden from us? Well, it could be that you're not ready for the truth, right? The 2,000 years that we're talking about, not you personally, but we, the 2,000 years we're talking about is a return of a great impression from a previous experience in Egypt when we oppressed the Jews, and the effect of that is in large part the ignorance that the Western world experienced, the reincarnation of Egyptian souls into the Western world. The effect of that has been to fall is to fall ignorant to these spiritual ideas that we had not been ready for, or that the Western world had not been ready for. And there was a...
Yes, there are individuals in the world whose discrimination is skewed, and they truly believe that the lies they tell are truths. How does that impact the event and the individual?
Right. So, there are folks in the world who are doing the thing that they know is the right thing to do because of the truths that they see in it. How do we justify that? How do we, you know, reconcile that? Well, the truth. Let's just say, you know, it's up to the individual to find the truth within himself, and it's there. And the truth does not vary from individual to individual because it is our nature. So each individual has within him the same, say, unit of measure of what truth is. We all have the same. So why in different cultures and different ways of thought are we killing each other because of different ways of what we think is the truth? It's not because their truth is different. Or our truth is different. It's because the individual, it's the responsibility of the individual to so refine his instrument so that he can see the truth for really what it is and then act from that basis. So if we're acting skewed from the truth, it's because we don't understand really what it is. Now, we may see someone else acting differently and skewed from the truth. And Mr. Crosby, really, frankly, very simply says, you know what, and it's in an article called True Morality. He says, you know what, just in situations like that, do what you can do for the other to help that other, in whatever way, get more of an appreciation for universal brotherhood. In other words, what Mr. Crosby is saying is help that individual to see the truth within himself. And we'll leave it at that.
What does it mean the truths will set you free? It seems that many people who tell the truth might find themselves in more hot water than they started out with. So what does that expression mean? The truth shall set you free.
Well, so what does the truth shall set you free? How does this impact us? The verse, the Bible verse, if you continue in my word, this is Jesus speaking, the words of Jesus, if you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Now, let's interpret that in the light of theosophy. The truth is in that statement. It's just a matter of the person educated with principles of theosophy to grasp it a little more clearly, and rarely will you find a Christian who's going to argue with this, we have found. So, if you continue in my word, translated is, if one lives life according to the ancient wisdom teachings, then you are truly disciples of mine. Translated, then he is a disciple of the self of all. Isn't that what Christ is? He's representative of the self, as is Buddha. And you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. He will learn the truth about himself. He will free himself from the illusion of separateness, and he'll free himself from falsely identifying with what was said, falsely identifying with the physical body. When he realizes who he truly is, he's freed from that. And how does he do that? By having his sins forgiven? No, that's the misconception. That's the literal real interpretation of the Western world of these teachings. We have to look at it in the light of universal ideas. And so it's following the teachings and applying them in your life, not following the man. It's studying for oneself. It's not listen to the priest. That's what theosophy is all about.
Thank you. The truth is that the next talk was supposed to be given by a student who unfortunately is ill and cannot be here today. So we'll do our best, but it'll just be our best. Do our best we can to express and talk about something that, well, something near and dear to all our hearts, gossip. What's wrong with gossip? It comes down to this. Every conversation we have is a moral act. And the reason for that is words are things. They have power. The power comes not only from the ideas and the emotion, but also the sound, the tone. There's a physical effect. And it develops the way we talk. Our conversation not only has an effect on our own character, how it develops, and the character of others. People listen to what we say and make judgments on our character and on the way they should behave too. Now, you may have heard sticks and stones can break my bones, but names will never hurt me. It's not true. It's one of those noble lies. Words hurt more than sticks and stones. You can heal a lot faster from a physical injury. The hurt from words can follow you for the rest of your life, and according to the devotional books, comes again in many other lives after that, the effects. So words do hurt, and because they have that effect, there must be laws, moral laws, of cause and effect, that if we understand that, can regulate our conversation. So we're going to look at three aspects. We're going to look at gossip, and we're going to distinguish it from criticism and flattery. Because they all go on in our gossip. So when we use the word gossip, we're not talking about the kind of conversation that we engage in because it leads to intimacy. And that's what makes gossip so pleasurable, because it is through conversation that we become closer. We break the ice, start talking. But then at some point where it becomes hurtful, that's where we want to make the distinction. So we're going to say that gossip represents hurtful conversation, which is not necessarily hateful, but it's hurtful in effect. And so applying the golden rule here, we could say that one rule regarding gossip could be when we're talking about someone or some group who, if they were present to hear what we had to say, would not appreciate it. So you know your gossip in the sense is perhaps more hurtful if they were present. You wouldn't say it because they wouldn't like it. What are the moral effects of gossip? And we're talking about the hurtful kind of speech. Well, it sets up a kind of separation between us and them. We wouldn't do that. How terrible of them. Makes us feel superior, holier, better than them. And probably worst, gossip doesn't always convey the truth. It can be just a repetition of something that was a rumor. And rumor spreads like wildfire. And gossip is one of the best, unfortunately, instruments of its dissemination. Cliques form around gossip. People get together and they talk. And very often, or not often, but it can happen that gossip can be used as a weapon. And here we're speaking of the kind of hypocrisy and that comes in with gossip. And probably we don't think about it, but every conversation with another human being, not only is it a moral act, it's an opportunity for growth, for experience, for learning, and for helping one another. So gossip in the wrong sense here, the hurtful sense, distracts us from the better use of our conversational speech. So in spite of all its comfort and its ways of making us intimate, we need to be aware of when our speech becomes hurtful, whether we'd want somebody to hear it if we were there, and the kinds of effects it has. Now, we know sometimes in our gossip we go into criticism. And we want to make the distinction between hurtful criticism and constructive criticism. You know, students of William Q. Judd said they would rather be criticized by him than praised by somebody else, because they knew through experience that his criticism was constructive and wasn't hurtful at all. So we're going to speak of criticism where it is definitely cruel and simply done with the motive, recognized or not, to make one feel superior, separate, or better than another. That's the wrong use of criticism. It becomes constructive when criticism is used to preserve feelings and relationships, the higher feelings and relationships. So if there is a relationship of between two people and they want to be constructive about their criticism, they'll tell one another things they see, they'll help each other recognize the faults and talk about them so they can eliminate them to preserve the hurt of feelings and function better in the relationship. That's a different kind of criticism. And it can be applied to any kind of relationship. The third area we want to finish up briefly is the difference between praise and flattery. Now, on the surface, flattery and praise sound completely different from criticism. We know when we're being praised or flattered, and we know when we're being criticized, constructively or otherwise. The difference is in the unseen part, the motive. So flattery, then, is when our motive is to benefit, we say something to benefit from the person we're flattering. So you flatter a boss because you think you might get a raise out of it. You flatter a teacher because you think you might get a better grade. It becomes praise when it's honest, sincere, in other words, and it's done without the ulterior motive of benefit to oneself. And this is where it gets difficult. This is where self-examination becomes very important. When praise is deserved, it should be given without hesitation, because it's honest and sincere and there's no motive. But if we sense that our praise is flattery, that there's some ulterior motive or hope for self-benefit or reward, that's where we need to begin to check ourselves. And so we present these ideas to give us some moral laws by which we can begin to regulate this moral act we call everyday conversation. So perhaps you have some questions or comments or conversation you want to bring up. Yes?
My grandfather had a wonderful lesson about praise. Even if it's deserved, he said, remember, it's like perfume. You're supposed to sniff at it, not drink it.
Yes. And some people are allergic to perfume, and they don't take praise well either. Okay. Yes?
About somebody else, but if it's positive, if it's concerned, and you're talking about them. So if it's a motive, a good motive, that you're doing it out of concern, but it's still negative ideas about them, what is that considered gossip?
Well, let's bring in our criteria in it. We're talking about somebody who's not present, yet the concern is genuine, and we want to help them. Would we say the same thing if they were sitting there with us? Would we be just as honest, as open? If not, if we would hold back, then perhaps we sense there's something hurtful in it or negative. On the other hand, if they were there and it was a relationship, they say, you know, so-and-so, you know, we're all trying to work together and we see that there's this thing you do and we didn't know if you were aware of it. We know you want to do the best you can. Would you consider this option? That's different. So are we talking now the same way when they're not there as when they are here? You know, there's that story from Plato, The Ring of Gyges, which is actually the basis of Tolkien's Lord of the Ring. But in the story that's told, Gyges, a shepherd, and he finds a buried ring of invisibility. And he puts it on, and it makes him invisible. Now, he's originally a good human being. But the lesson of the story, or what the challenge put to Socrates is that a human being, if they think they're not going to be seen or detected, is more likely to do evil. That people are not necessarily good or just in themselves, but they do it because they don't think they're going to be detected. That's what is challenged. Now, of course, Socrates refuted that, and you can go to the Republic, second chapter, and read about it if you want. But that's the point. Are we saying something that if we knew it wasn't invisible, that it was detected and known by all or by the other person, would we still say it? Question?
Well, don't sometimes people gossip to receive, like, comfort about, like, maybe a wrong that was done to them, so all of a sudden they start talking about someone, you know, just to try to get that off their mind?
Yes. Well, somebody's been hurt,
right,
by words, and they go to somebody they can trust, and they'll talk about it. Now, they don't go to somebody they haven't already established that intimacy with through conversation. So there's a certain trust in there, a certain confessional attitude that what they tell them will be treated appropriately, that they won't be, it won't sometime come back to them as a weapon. Somebody will use it against them or go around telling what they said. There's a certain trust there. And in that kind of environment where one is bearing one's soul and hurt and the effects one has with someone else, it's really not done to hurt the other person, but really to help balance, learn from it within themselves. And they need to express it with someone because they haven't learned it themselves. And we think that probably if they had the relationship with the other person who wounded them, or by their thought or their deed, maybe they would prefer to go to that person, but they know they can't. There's just too much that's happened, and so they have to do it. It's a different motive, a different circumstance. But once again, the standard is, if the other person could be there under the right circumstance, would they talk about it? Would they talk honestly and openly with that person about what they feel from what was said, what could be done different? And we think that is a good rule to apply there.
And
yes,
what you also said about criticism, can't people in some circumstances and some people take the criticism, even if it was dished out negatively, to improve themselves anyway, no matter how hurtful some of the criticism is, you know, some of it you could still take and reevaluate yourself to see if it can bring about.
So it's a wonderful point. Constructive criticism can be ignored. Even destructive criticism can be used to one's benefit, to learn from. Our enemies are our teachers as much as our friends, because our enemies don't hold back. They'll tell us the truth in a hurtful way about ourselves, whether we're ready to hear it or not, whether we can deal with it or not. Whereas a friend is really more likely to wait till the right circumstance and opportunity and way it can be done. So we can learn from teachers as much as from friends, but once again, as was brought out this morning, we need to bring a certain attitude, a certain knowledge, a certain stance to that awareness. Yes?
How should we treat flattery? If someone is flattering us and we suspect they're doing it for a motive, how do we respond to that?
How would you respond to it? We assume you've all been flattered at some point by your children because they want an allowance or whatever. Teachers may be flattered by a student. Yes?
In the book, The Prince, the line is given, shun the flatterer.
Shun flattery.
Shun the flatterer.
Yes. Beware of praise in that sense. In the voice of the silence, it speaks of neither praise or criticism, paraphrasing here, affect thee not. In your higher nature, whether you're being praised or flattered or criticized, it doesn't really affect you in your higher nature in terms of destroying you. What you want to watch out for is you're not elated by praise or flattery. Don't get a big head. And you're not cast down and beating yourself up from criticism, whether constructive or otherwise. This is the most important aspect of this, is how do we individually respond to it. And when you do study yourself that way, you will automatically become more attentive, more careful in your conversation. And it's not so much not to avoid things, but we want to make better use, especially when theosophists come together, or people of similarity of aim and purpose and teaching, same goals in life come together. It's a wonderful opportunity to gear their conversation towards a higher end rather than just in the, I won't say lower, but more everyday convention of gossip. So we'll stop here with gossip, and we're going to go to the third aspect. And, you know, sometimes it says...
Well, I don't want to flatter you, but I think you did a very good job standing in for somebody.
Oh, we'll take that. Thank you. Our third presentation has to do with the subject. You know, there's that expression, silence is golden, and it's true. And... so often, the idea of being meek and quiet and accepting and dealing with things, but sometimes you just have to speak up and fight back and use your words, your power of speech. And so our third presentation on this subject is it always wrong to fight back?
I feel like the guy cleaning up behind the elephants in the circus coming to town. Everything that I thought I was going to say has already been said, but I'll try it again in a new way. Is it always wrong to fight back? This isn't an easy question for spiritually inclined. Many of the attitudes and ideas we grew up with hamper a clear understanding and answer. We've all heard an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth from the Old Testament and attributed to the Mosaic Law. Is the physical resistance implied in that quote the only way to repel transgressors? And make no mistake, they have to be repelled. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna informs his student, Arjuna, saying, I produce myself among creatures, O you son of Bharata, whenever there is a decline of virtue and an insurrection of vice and injustice in the world. And thus, I incarnate from age to age for the preservation of the just, the destruction of the wicked, and the establishment of righteousness. Surely then, there's a time when fighting is not only just, but mandatory. Fighting to defend the defenseless is your obligation. Fighting injustice is the duty that we're all obliged to undertake if we wish to be worthy of the title civilized. This brings us to the meaning of fighting. When we hear the word fight, we tend to think of war, the use of violence, a battle, and etc. But the dictionary also defines fighting as to struggle determinedly, to oppose something, to exert a major effort. The application of these nine war principles have been demonstrated by such modern movements as those led by Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Lech Walesa. One of the most mystifying statements in the New Testament is resist not evil. To resist evil strengthens it. Wars are the results of resisting evil. And the consequent is a disturbance of universal harmony. The reality that hate cannot overcome hate is proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. The nonviolence movement mentioned earlier did not resist evil. They rejected its authority and stripped it of its power. Is there ever a time when we must, like Arjuna, fight the physical war? And if so, what guidance can be given that will result in the best possible circumstances at the end? In that wonderful book, The Ocean of Theosophy, Prophet Muhammad is mentioned among the avatars, and his attributes are listed as civil, military, and religious. Perhaps the recognition given his military expertise stems from the absence of revenge in warfare. He spent 10 years of his life at war with the city-state of Mecca, who had made threats of beheading him and his disciples and enslaving their women. And yet when he overcame his opponents after entering the city with only a loss of 28 lives, he spared all of those, even his most harshest critics, those who hated him the most, he spared their lives. And that was a very rare act for that particular time and place. When the victor allows the defeated to continue without the necessity or the obligation of getting even, the conflict has a chance to end and the wounded feelings have a chance to heal. Now, these same principles mentioned above can be applied to our personal lives and relationships. One of the yoga aphorisms of Patanjali's, who is considered the father of Hindu psychology, writes, states, undisturbed calmness of the mind is attained by cultivating friendliness towards the happy, mercy and compassion for the unhappy, delight for the virtuous, and indifference towards wickedness.
So whatever was said there about standing up, passive resistance, nonviolence, in terms of physical, also incorporates the principles of speech, because you're express ourselves. Yes.
In the Secret Doctrine, HPB speaks about the Eye of Kapila, where this adept defended, or rather killed off in the process of defending, something like 60,000, I think was the number, lots of thousands. So the question is it acceptable in the line of defense to commit these acts or not? Or was he unique because he was an adept?
Everything, everything depends on motivation. What was the motivation behind this? The 60,000 that were killed, had they lived, what would they have done? Were they innocent people that they were going to attack? Were they, what were their matters? What was he opposing? And what was his motive for opposing it? That's what it really breaks down to. The act itself is just what's on the visible plane. What you have to search for this is that which comes before the act.
You were mentioning again to be indifferent towards evil. There's also an expression, what is it? Resist not evil? Is that
yes.
The expression? Are they related? Or one's indifference almost sounds like, well, one's doesn't care one way or the other. Is that what you meant?
We, just a moment ago, we were speaking of gossip. And one of the greatest things that makes gossip a business and an industry in this particular society is the fact that people buy the newspaper. They fan that about. This is the same thing. There was also in that statement about war. Wars come about because people are resisting evil. You make a thing bigger than it is. You blow it out of proportion. To show an indifference is to not acknowledge its power or not acknowledge it. That strips it of its power. Yes, sir.
Just an interesting observation is the fourth object of the Theosophical Movement, which is to actively oppose materialism and dogmatism in all its form. And it almost seems HPB is exhorting us to act positively when you see it, do something about it.
Well,
in other words, don't be passive. If it's in your presence. If dogma is in your presence, correct the ideas. It's your duty. That's how we interpret it.
I don't see that would be in contradiction. If we take it word by word, it would seem to be a conflict. But it's not in contradiction when you look at the spirit of it. You're encouraged to defend the defenseless. You're encouraged to stand up to injustice. So therefore, you're not saying that you just lay down and allow it to roll over you, no more than the people who practice passive resistance. They put their bodies on the line and suffered greatly, but they never fought back. And this is the same thing. You're not in opposition. One is not in opposition to another, but it is perhaps a limitation of the words or a misunderstanding of the words, but the intention is there to oppose it. Yes, ma'am.
What about bullying, like with children? What do you tell them? Like, you know, if they're being bullied at school, should they fight back or put up with it?
It's one of the most difficult questions. We all have children. We don't want to see them terrorized and afraid to go to school. And often that's what bullying leads to. Often also, this comes under the same heading of defending the defenseless. When you see bullies rise up and make school that much of a hell for one child, that means that those who are in charge are not paying attention. They're not defending the defenseless. So when you're encouraged to defend the defenseless, that covers that particular aspect of what we're speaking of. Yes, sir.
With regard to this in particular, it's very interesting. There's a theosophical book here that you can get through the ULT. It's called Because, for Children Who Ask Why. And in that story, the question is asked from the little girl, little boy to his older aunt, and she says yes. fight back against the bully, it's justified. And I was reading this aloud to a five-year-old, and I didn't know it was going to say that. And I was just very surprised that this Theosophical Children's Book actually said that.
Well, you know...
But if it's the truth, it's the truth.
Yeah, well, and not only that, you know, often people, in fact, not often, most of the times, people do things out of ignorance, not having any idea of how it feels to be put on the wrong end of that type of treatment. Not until they taste the brew that they made do they understand how bitter it is. So sometimes a slap in the mouth. It's a very interesting story. Please allow me to digress. This is a woman who is a doctor at a psychiatric hospital in New York. And she had a really tough job. I'm trying to think of the name. One of the most famous psychiatric hospital in New York City.
Bellevue.
I think it's Bellevue. She was an emergency admitting doctor in that establishment, and often they would bring in these homeless people to her, and she grew a callus over her soul. That is to say, she had to undress these people, and she spoke about how, as you took off each layer of clothes, the more repulsive it became. And she got to the point where she couldn't see their humanity. One night they bring this guy in. He's calm when they bring him in. But she begins to talk to him, and as she's undressing him, she's berating him, she's putting him down. And without warning, he reached out and slapped her. And it scared her. And he, you know, made a break. They had to grab him and restrain him. But she said, and this was on it had better come to me. Anyway, though, she said that it was the best thing that ever happened to her. She said, because you cannot service somebody, you cannot give them your best treatment if you don't see them as a human being. And she realized when he slapped her that he was a human being, that he did have feelings, and that he was worthy of her respect, regardless to his physical condition. But she was still scared for a couple of weeks afterwards because she thought he was going to follow her home. So every once in a while, yeah, sometimes it's good to taste that. You know, you make these brews, you taste it for a minute. And that's what happened with her.
We were wondering, though, if we don't at some point come to grips where we speak of that soul as being peaceful, but in some devotional books it's also referred to as the warrior soul. In the Bhagavad Gita we have the idea of the just war, the duty of the warrior. And at some point, we have to fight back against our lower nature. You can give it, and at some point, and have to say enough is enough. So a lot can be said for standing up to the wrongs of others, but would we be better off directing more of our attention to our own nature? There's enough weaknesses and wrongs in our own nature we need to stand up to.
Incidentally, too. All of the avatars who appear before us, very seldom do they come with instructions for the care and the maintenance of our physical. They come with bearing messages to uplift our spiritual. That's the important thing. When you say fight back and we worry, oh, well, he's going to hit this guy, he's going to hit that guy, that is counterproductive sometimes to the elevation of the soul. Yes, sir.
I have a dilemma with passive resistance, like what Gandhi's done, even though I respect him greatly, and what he's done is beyond my even ability to imagine how anybody can do that. But had we exercised passive resistance, would we be speaking German now, you know, 50 years later, after, you know, what happened in Germany in 1945? So my dilemma is always passive versus aggressive. Resistance.
Well, that's really a difficult question. Would we be speaking German now if we had practiced passive resistance? Let's look at the history of those who wish to overtake the world. whether it's Alexander the Great, Hitler, Mussolini, any of them. How many of them have succeeded? There seems to be, along with the resistance, the physical resistance, there seems to be some sort of stopgap measure, perhaps, in the very nature of humanity. All of these men who wish to overtake the world, what they invited upon themselves was nothing but grief. None of them ever end up well. Mussolini was found hanging in the streets. Hitler took his own life. And from what I understand, Alexander the Great ended up as a drank himself pretty much to death. That desire to overtake the world seems to be self-retarded even in its own aspects. Even if we were speaking German, does that mean it would have lasted long? Because we might have went to Chinese after that or something else. Does that mean that that's the end of the game because we speak that language? Even those people that he overcome, in their hearts of hearts, they still desire freedom, justice, and equality as long as he lives and beyond.
If I could just follow up on that.
Yes.
There was, so to speak, passive resistance during Stalin's time, and 40 million Stalin.
Hmm.
40 million people died as a result of that passive resistance. Granted, it ended in 1989, 1990. 40 million? Is it worth it?
If you read the Gita, and in a very, I think it's chapter 2 of the Gita, 40 million bodies perished. Those souls are not perished, and they come back. Often they come back with the same intuition, the same rhythm that they left with. Freedom and the desire for freedom doesn't die because you kill the body.
Thank you. So far, whether we're looking at it from the point of view of the golden rule or how we use our, what we do for the poor and weak, the way we speak, we're pretty much dealing with our relationships with other human beings. But how about the moral decisions and the moral and ethical problems we have in relationship to our environment? And by that we mean the intelligence in the kingdoms around us. So our final two presentations will address this issue of the moral decisions we all face, whether we know it or not, in our relationships. And our first presentation asks the question, why should I recycle?
It's fun that this particular consideration follows the use of the voice, because in many ways we play great lip service to the environment, to ecology, to what is green living, and we get used to hearing certain buzzwords or phrases that we kind of accept, maybe even without real consideration. We know Earth Day just passed on April 22nd. But also we hear things in the environment like live simply that others may simply live, or think globally and act locally, or be the change you wish to see. And sometimes the earth is spoken of as an ark, other times as a Gaia principle. And behind the use of these words is concepts and practices that are based on motive. And we know that in the why should I recycle or why should I live a green life, there's a whole spectrum of motives that's possible, ranging from selfish through gradations to self-centered through more gradations to selfless. Theosophically speaking, we're familiar with the term ahimsa, do no harm. But we're very aware as thinkers as living life and trying to practice the art and science of living, that we might have mixed motives at any one time, that we may sense mixed motives at any one time in those around us, and that with knowledge, with openness and honesty and the willingness to see, premises may change, intuition may bloom, and recycling becomes a reflection of one's attitude at any given time in this process of growth, or this process of living in a mindful way. So how are these motives reflected in attitudes? Well, we know we see some folks acting as though the environment and the lives of the environment are resources to be exploited. And we would place them certainly on that spectrum toward the selfish end. And on the other hand, they may be using those materialistic degrees of wealth in order to protect those that they love. We know that it's possible to see that there are others that see renewable or sustainable energy as something to be stewarded, and they see themselves as a steward of natural resources and the environment. They see it as though they were graced by some deific principle or God with these commodities to be used. And again, there's some place on that spectrum of motive and premises from which they are using logic. Theosophically, that Gaia principle that many are thinking of right now is most closely affiliated with the notion of universal brotherhood, or being at one with the environment. And resident in that, for those who accept reincarnation and karma as principles with which to test their lives and to think about the environment, that notion of universal brotherhood, of all degrees of intelligence behind all manifestation of form, and what looks to be matter or spirit and a degree of mind reflected through matter, that kind of experience is best gained in the last 18 million years where we are now, on a plane that we share, and we're sharing the air and the substance of this room. We are sharing the life force in this room. We are sharing the facilities of the physicalities as though we are one entity, mind being reflected through a spectrum of forms. And so does the environment really matter? Should we as individuals make an effort to preserve the environment? Well, we can answer that question with more questions to be considered in our private moments of meditation. Is the Hermetic premise that as above, so below, the truth? And if so, is there any division between nature and the human? And if not, are we to proceed whether right now our premise is that there's only a sempiternity, one life, or whether we are holding with the notion of reincarnation, if that seems to make more sense? Is this environment actually the playground, the interaction, the symbiosis of the survival of all sentient beings, no matter how finite or no matter how developed toward the infinite? And so each of us, as the 18th chapter of the Gita lays out for us, each of us has to consider, on what basis do we come to this moral dilemma of when to use and when to refrain from using, or how to use and how to share, and what degree of self-serving actions we're willing to put into this environment, physical, spiritual, psychic, that will bring results for us all. For truly, brotherhood is at stake. We could consider this moral dilemma from the viewpoint of the three fundamentals, and certainly the secret doctrine, the key, the Gita, all of our literature that we've been so blessed to have with us, offers information about the source of the environment, the nature of the universal intelligence in the environment, the nature of the spiraling or the cycling of the natural focus on recycling that goes on in all aspects of great nature, and our work as humans to help with the spiritual evolution as well as the physical. Writing poetry in California is an individual named Gary Snyder. And in one of his poems, he had this to say: "This living, flowing land is all there is forever. We are it. It sings through us. We could live on this earth without clothes or tools." And certainly the whole notion of relativity, MC squared, the whole notion of what it is to be a spirit in action is reflected in those words. So metaphysically, all states develop together, and we're invited to make every effort to consider our motives and to nurture wisely.
Thank you.
Uh-oh.
Any questions?
Yes?
Well, the whole concept, we were always surprised that it took recycling such a long time to be developed. And then they realized that in order to make it work, it had to be made easier for people to do it. So now there's the single stream recycling. But we're always amazed that the trash that's around. And what is it about human beings that is not something that is being the steward of the land?
You know, it's an interesting thing. Recycling has been the way of the world from the very, very beginning. And it would seem that the closer souls are to living in great nature, the closer they are to living in an agrarian economy, or hunting and gathering economy, or in a scarcity economy, the more they naturally go with the flow of recycling. And it would appear that what we see as the throwaway society here in the United States, of wealth without responsibility. Even the poorest among us in this country are affluent in comparison to the poverty stricken around the world. And in many ways, the passive aggression of throwing something on the street, of using something only once and tossing it away, is more a lack of awareness. It's more a lack of mindfulness, and more just a lack of thought about what the world would be. If we consider ourselves today as we came here, how many of us drove here alone? How many of us use public transportation? In terms of packing a lunch or bringing a lunch, or what mode of use of resources did we use? And again, the high motive of trying to commune together so that we are a force together, so that we share a oneness of spirit and psychic energy and motive and a wish to help the theosophical movement, as well as to share the fellowship of the physicality. Those motives were good and pure. Did we also take the time to think about the environment? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe we had to sacrifice one that would be dear for something that we needed to do to get here. Yeah.
Yeah, aren't all those, though, I mean, the idea of the built-in waste and obsolescence, aren't those like the traits of a market economy?
Yes. Yeah, that planned obsolescence, I'm going to greatly date myself. The ice box that my mother inherited from her mother was still alive and well in my uncle's garage for summer use well into the early 1970s. That little thing just kept pushing on. Today's appliances for the marketing principle, for exploitation, for the bottom line profit margin, means that so many of our appliances are really only planned for so long so that they will die and we have to replace them, or worse, with certain industries that we can think of, every so often, maybe it's a 6-month cycle, an 18-month cycle, but periodically there's a new and better version of whatever the toy is, and we see people lining up for days at a time so that they can trade in whatever appliance they've got for the next newer and better. Oh, there's one now being held up. But again, all of this is the manipulation of psychic energies, the manipulation of the physicality of the environment, and what's at prey but that thinker who passively goes with the flow without stopping to consider what the implications are. Yeah.
In Europe, they're like really ahead of America when it comes to this, and in terms of efficiency and in terms of awareness of the public and recycling. We remember, we lived there for a few years, and if you wanted the garbage man to pick up your garbage truck, there's one kind of a garbage bag it goes into. It's a certain color, and you buy it at the local grocery store, and it costs you money, and it's got to fit into that. And if you want them to pick up two bags, then you pay twice as much. Mm-hmm. And they're small bags for a family for a week, and you've got to figure out, or you're going to pay more. Another example of that was in the hospital business in Europe. The company that sells the product to the hospital pays to have the product thrown away, and the box that it came into, they pay the price to get that thrown away. So they pay for the garbage that they produce. And so it's just amazing the awareness of it when they charge. And then there's also the standards in Europe for manufacturing. Mm-hmm. We think it's called like ISO 9000, so that this whole planned obsolescence is not affecting them as much as when an American company wants to sell their products, very often they have to re-gear their whole production capacity to meet that quality standard, or European companies aren't allowed to buy the product and sell it in Europe. Very interesting.
And that's governmental regulation, but certainly we can do that within our own communities, whether our community is an apartment house or whether it's a neighborhood or a block. There are many, many communities of thinkers pulling together, becoming more aware. Front lawns are being turned into mini farms, and the produce is being shared. There are other communities where there are periodic yard sales, but not really, because it's pennies on a dollar, and the money goes back into the school for a little scholarship or some activity for the local kids. But there's the swap meet attitude of the beloved hand-me-downs, where one bicycle might move through 4 or 5 households for children and wind up the transportation for an adult in yet another house. There are many, many ways, if only we bring our awareness and our energy to solutions, many ways to copy old concepts of recycling that certainly are tried and true. Yeah.
It seems like we're humanity's fighting a losing battle regarding recycling, because there is no technology out there today that is capable of consuming energy in order to recycle and using less energy to get out of it. In other words, it takes more energy for us to recycle than we get back from recycling. Hence, the money and extra expenses as such. Until that technology comes along, we will always be on the losing end, so to speak. And there are accounts of ancient technologies that were able to do that without losing that energy aspect.
Well, let's go back to the opening statement again. One of the buzzwords that we passively accept, be the change you wish to see. Do we have to wait as thinkers, as karmic agents, for cost-efficient technology, for governmental means by which to accomplish something? Or could we, in our quiet moments of our morning meditations when we pre-plan our day, our evening meditations when we sit in reflection on how did we do with the art of living this day, might we not begin to recycle ancient ways and the natural ways within our own hearts, within our own little sphere of influence, our homes, and then gradually build alliances with others so that instead of purchasing something in the market that has packaging galore involved with it, or factory food that's been processed and has caused all sorts of havoc in the environment in other vicinities, why not think about purchasing those products that are the most simple? That something that we could prepare in our own homes with no plastic waste, no material waste, no agribusiness or factory food effect anywhere else, but just living simply in a way that appears to be best to us at any one moment in time. And in that way, gradually seeding the spiritual and the psychic environment with the ideas of right living and pursuing that. Yeah.
Interesting. The second entity you mentioned was government. And the study will show you that government has never spearheaded a social movement. It always comes in after the citizens spearhead it, and then they you know, legalize it or legitimize it or help it. But they never spearhead. We cannot wait for the government to do what we need to have done. We have to take that on our own.
In the 60s and the 70s, there was a social revision of the Pledge of Allegiance. And in essence, one aspect of it was my country, right or wrong, when right to be kept right, when wrong to be put right. And the caveat to that was that the truly active citizen is the thinker who leads so that the leaders will only follow. And those notions can really help us out a lot.
But it's clear, I mean, we can all go to many websites and books to get practical ideas, but underlying it all is an awareness of, do we owe anything to the environment? What is our obligation to the environment and why?
Yeah. And the third fundamental, certainly all three fundamentals of the philosophy, is really pertinent to, do we owe anything to the environment? And as thinkers, in these physical temples that we use, we live in body, we live in brain, we live in sheaths of substance, and working through those sheaths of substance, we are capable of impressing all of the lives at every plane of existence across time and age and space, in the nature of our thinking, in our nature of our heart, and all of the vibrations that we bring to any degree of substance, all of the strength that we can add to the natural ways of all degrees of intelligence, we owe a tremendous debt. As we look around us, we know that all forms are cast off from prior rounds and races and prior use of humanity. And therefore, these are all the lower substances and forms we can envision and experience. We owe a degree of thank you to that substance, to that degree of intelligence that once housed the very intelligence that has bloomed and is radiating through all of us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
When H.P. Blavatsky was writing about the issue of animal rights, whether we see it in The Key to Theosophy or in articles, the main issue was there of vegetarianism.
is it morally wrong to eat meat, or vivisection. But in our times, more animals suffer from in providing safe cosmetics for us, personal care products, life-saving medications. You probably did use some type of personal care product or substance today, which animals were directly used to prove their safety to human beings, which means either unwittingly or unexpectedly bringing harm to them. And besides that, we have the whole issue of zoos. Some animals display the same behavior as prisoners in solitary confinement. They pace, they engage in self-destructive behavior. So it's around us. And to help us make us more aware, we'll have our next presentation on Do Animals Have Rights?
Hello, everyone. This morning, the first speaker started talking about motion in the universe, unity, and that how that motion gets dispersed. When we go to the Secret Doctrine, page 189 to 193, the explanation given is that the one life referred to this morning is the expression of Akasha. In other words, the one life gives intelligence to all of the kingdoms up to men. Besides giving all that it does to the lower kingdoms, it gives us something more. Let us look and see what that is. To the mineral kingdom, it gives polarity. To the plant, it gives color and aroma. To the animal, it gives instinct. To the human being, all of those plus consciousness, making us self-conscious being, which is the highest development of the evolutionary process. So we see that peaking of intelligence, intuition, discrimination in men. For that reason, it is stated that we owe all of the lower kingdoms responsible action, responsible, beneficent protection, and that we need to live that life every single day. We talked today about unity, about consciousness being on a continuum, that we come repeatedly to Earth, and that this life in physical existence is for the evolution of the soul. Now, do we have souls or are we souls? Is it only humanity that has or starts with a soul? Do animals have souls? HPB, in her magnificent article called Psychic and Noetic Action, tells us that all life has a memory of its own kind, and it is intelligent. So what exactly are the animals then? We have heard the statement made that the animals are made of our cast-off materials. But what exactly does that mean? We are souls. Our evolutionary process is to bring that soul to its highest expression, which then becomes one with a spirit, the one life itself. If the memory recorded in our materials then is leaning towards the higher aspect of our lives, then the material or the protoplasmic material used in the animal will express the memory of what is recorded, because it is stated that the body of man is made up of 40,000 tons of material, that all human beings share the same material. But how much of that material, then, do we share with the animal world? And how do we affect them? The protoplasm, then, is part of us, and it carries its memory. What else are we giving them? Psychic ability, because we're transferring it, and astral ability, because animals do not have individuality. They are souls, they have souls, but they have group souls. There was one article where it was stated that in the animal kingdom, that moving towards individuality becomes apparent in dogs and elephants, but they are group souls. So when they die then, do they go to Devakan? They're not individuals, so obviously they do not. They immediately are reborn. So what is our responsibility to the animal world? H.P. Binder article makes it very clear, and she uses the word salutary beneficence, meaning that animals have their natural tendencies and that they need to be allowed to live their natural lives, that if we are to be mindful of being beneficent to the animals, we do not have to put ribbons on them, we do not have to put them in synthetic environments, but we need to allow them to express what comes natural to them. When we look around today, how are we treating our animals? We mentioned the zoos. Do we have the right to put them in the zoos? We take them out of their natural environment and we put them in synthetic environments. What about the products that come about from animal substance? And we just said that that animal substance is really human substance. If we do not put it to its natural use, what happens there? In an article of HPB, she explains that reversion or going backwards happens. And she gives the example, for instance, if we are looking to get a pet and we choose one, how do we choose that pet? Because we go towards it. There is an affinity between the owner and the animal. Where does that affinity come from? Well, from this particular explanation, it would be that it is either karmic or that the substance contained in that form has affinity to us. How should we treat the animal? If we look at it from the universal viewpoint, then our action would be universal and beneficent. We would not take it as a biological entity that we feel affinity towards. Because if we follow that line of activity, we are addressing it from our own personal self. Which principle would be active there then? If we are doing rajasic and tamasic activity, and I'm sure you're all familiar with that, rajasic would be perhaps expressed anger towards the animal, and tamasic would be indifference. We would feel no compassion for the animal whatsoever. But the true beneficence comes when we treat the animal as a byproduct of our own substance and its life being salutary. We talked about nature and its efficient way of dealing with all of life. So, in other words, they are our future humanity. And when you look at the psychology of the East, whether it is Hinduism, Brahmanical, or Buddhism, they look at the animal as their younger brothers. But we in the West laugh at that psychology. But it is really true. They are our younger brothers, considering the one life gives particular characteristics to the life wave as it goes from the mineral, plant, animal, to human. So we are all interconnected. Our universe is interconnected. Our position then becomes custodial, because we use all of the material in the universe. We find it in a particular way. How are we leaving it? The imprints that we put on it should be beneficent. In other words, as the previous speaker said, it should be uplifting it.
Thank you. Yes.
So you mentioned that animals are not individualized. Do they then have group karma? How do they... How does karma work?
Well, it actually mentions it here. But when we treat animals, we treat them separately, don't we? If we are abusing an animal, we're not abusing all of them, are we? But as they're interconnected also as a group, for instance, all of the dogs having a class action, we affect all of that life within that kingdom. Yes?
What does somebody do with, like, animals that, like, infringe on their own personal space? Take, for instance, like, termites. Your house gets, like, infested.
Yes. Well, this student hasn't thought about that problem, but they do eat your house. That is true. But it is detrimental to ourselves to kill them. There must be some way we can get rid of them without killing them. In the underdeveloped world, actually, termite is a source of nutrition because they're high in protein.
we might mention there that in line with that, as our role as thinkers and the way we impact and share lots of our nature with the lower kingdoms, if there are noxious, infectious, harmful insects, animals, in a sense, it's the impression we give them that over the course of evolution, as we raise our termitic nature to one that's more constructive and not so destructive of the structures of others, we lift up the intelligence in those kingdoms. So in a sense, it's a karmic experience. But on the other hand, getting into the whole idea of standing up, protection, motive comes in here. If it's your responsibility to protect and defend an environment, then you need to do what you can in the least harmful way, least suffering way to that creature as you can, not just to protect the humanity, but also to preserve your respect and brotherliness with the lower kingdom.
The fact that we take animals and we bring them into our homes, and many times we talk to them as if they were people and so forth. Now, are we accelerating their evolution, or are we hindering it by making them our pets?
It is stated that it hinders because they are not expressing their natural characteristics. In this particular article, it addressed it in this way. It said that some of the animals who are trained by human beings show pseudo-intelligence. It is not a real gain, but what we are transferring to them, because it's a two-way road. They transfer some of theirs to us, but we are also transferring some of ours. And this comes from that sattvic quality, that we want to be beneficent to them, but we don't know exactly how to be beneficent to them. And it was definitely against putting them in synthetic environment, ribbons and stuff of that nature, but that they have a salutary, in other words, beneficent to themselves, lifestyle that they need to live. And the other thing mentioned here was that the unhealthy breeding that goes on in the animal kingdom is not to their advantage, because some of the lines are being crossed, and the reference was made to our selfish but unaware causation during the third race, and then knowingly, with full responsibility, cross-referencing the animal world again in the Atlantic race, that commitment on our part has branchlets that shows through the psychic of the human and is transferred to the animal.
Just think of the difference between the animal we train as a pet versus the animal we train to be a guard dog or a attack dog versus a companion or therapy dog or a seeing eye dog. In other words, it's not just a matter of taking them out of their natural intelligence. Yeah. But if we're going to do that, what is our responsibility if we're going to inflict our own intelligence on it? How do we use it? And there, of course, motive comes in to be so important. In the back.
We were reading recently that a lot of organizations are, especially, they're using dogs and going back to the reason why they were bred and allowing them, I'm having a hard time phrasing this, and using them in public life, but doing what comes naturally to them. And like, the guard dogs, like German Shepherds and Dobermans and all, they were bred way, way, way back to do that. So even they're trying to, if they need a guard dog, then they're using those. But it's the pets, you know, that it just feels like we're really hampering them by, you know, we're pampering them and all that. It's just such a complicated issue.
It's complicated, but in another way, it is very simple. The motive power comes in first. The thought has the greatest potency of doing wrong. We are supposedly civilized, but in the olden days, because of the wisdom exhibited among the populace, we knew exactly what to do. But today, it's kind of hit and miss. HPB's article makes absolutely no qualms about condemning this cross-referencing. This student is not an authority on breeding, so I can't really say whether those special breeds that we're bringing about are really for the benefit of the dog kingdom. And the other responsibility is, what happens to these animals? Do we show them gratitude? For instance, horses and oxen, for instance, when they get old, they can no longer work. Are we taking care of them in their old age, or we discard them like they didn't mean anything to us? The previous speaker said, we use all of the material of our universe, and indeed we do, but we also owe it gratitude for what we do use, and I don't think we express it a lot these days.
Thank you. Can you stand up here for the next session?
Yes.
Okay. For our last segment, our last time here, we're going to open it up, as we said, to general questions and answers on anything that we mentioned already, or if there's another soul-searching question you'd like to bring up. And we're going to set it up is we're going to have three people up here, a student from each one of the representing each one of the lodges. So.
Body, that psychic nature that we have. For instance, forces, they pick up on that immediately, mm-hmm. what state your mind is in and your body. Mm-hmm. Are all kingdoms the same way? I mean, as far as, you know, dogs and cats, and is that our avenue of communication? Rather than
I'm sorry, verbal? What's your question? Are we adding?
No, how is it that we communicate with them best? Is it through our psychic nature or our feeling nature or astral body? Or is it simply...
Well, they have instinct, so that corresponds in you too, because we do have instinct. It's just that our instinct no longer is precision-oriented because we have lost the capacity to use it appropriately. Now we're in the process of developing intuitive and discriminative powers, which are the higher aspects of the divine mind. But in the animal kingdom, instinct works perfectly 100% of the time. So they do have that instinct, and they either gyrate towards you or they don't. And you feel it, and so does the animal, because its feeling nature is electricity. And it sends that on that, what we call the electromagnetic route, and you feel it. So that's how the communication takes place. And they do have senses, and they do understand the emotions you are expressing. Mm-hmm. It's not the animal that's expressing emotion, because mm-hmm. they don't. It's you who is expressing the emotion, and the animal picks it up. If you're telling it off and you use severe voice, the animal knows that's not your soft nature. They understand where you're coming from. It's not the animal that's expressing it. It's you who's doing the expression. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What would Childlike has made studies about how animals communicate and so on. He's actually written a book about how does your dog know that you're coming home. And he positions that there are fields all over that interconnect everything.
It is correct. You know what that is.
Which would underline exactly the theosophical concept of the one life.
Correct. Astral, and the previous speaker said that, everything is recorded in the astral light, and it reflects back on us.
We recently saw a show on dolphins and whales, and this was incredible. There were two divers in deep water, and a whale came up, and the poor thing was covered in a net, and it was inflicting one of its flippers from moving, and it was around its mouth. It came by itself right up to one of the divers, and the other diver came over, and the two of them took the netting and everything off.
Mm.
And as the whale was going away, it like turned around, wiggled its tail like it was thanking them. And it was... I mean, so there is, when we're talking about the one life,
mm-hmm.
there is, even though people hunt, different nations hunt these whales,
mm-hmm.
it's like they still have have an affinity, and there have been multitude of stories about dolphins protecting people from sharks. So there is that one life, and it seems like these higher animals seem to be more connected with humans, from what studies have shown.
But the opposite view also exists, that dolphins are wild and that they can harm you, and this also has been proven. So they are wild animals, and we need to be careful as to how we approach them. But when they're in need of help, obviously they know how to get it also, because they have that instinctive survival feeling in them as well. Perhaps you would like to answer some of these questions?
Well, I'm just there. So many hands. I know.
I don't want to monopolize the floor.
I'm just curious, according to like a theosophical approach, do people ever incarnate as animals? Or people just only reincarnate as other people.
Oh, once you're a man, you're a man. Oh, sorry. You go.
That's fine. No, no,
you
no, no,
go.
No,
you, no.
You can finish up.
Go ahead. Well, in theosophy, it is stated that once you have entered the human kingdom, you're always a human. But of course, there are differences in the stages of that too. Because at first, we're the animal human. Once we move from the animal kingdom into the human kingdom, we have that evolutionary process that provides for that. And when you look around the world, you can see how differences exhibit themselves in different countries, for instance. And HBB always says, those are our younger brothers who have not had a long period of evolution to become humane. And once we become humane, then we move towards divinity in us, which is that higher aspect that we're developing towards becoming divine human beings, which the elder brothers or the perfected beings show us how to achieve. And today we talk a whole bunch about that, how to cultivate the higher nature, how to be altruistic, how to not give into our lower nature, to control those lower tendencies, because we all have them.
But yeah. Can I interrupt? Because let's talk a little bit about evil.
Oh.
And although it's true that the human soul that is connected with the spiritual and the divine never goes back, yet the human mind can so influence the qualities or the principles in nature that the only thing it brings out of them is the darkness and the animal nature. So on the one hand, when we're resonating with the animals and we're lifting them up, as has been said, we're tickling those higher principles within them. When we tickle the lower principles, I mean, HPB says we're musical instruments. So if we're playing all of the wrong tunes and awakening the animal nature in the animal and in ourselves, because again, we're looking in the mirror, those atoms, as she says, that we bring back to ourselves that make up the vehicle that the soul becomes encased in, can be extremely animalistic. And then we have to engage in great battle with our lower nature.
And the other final aspect of that is that although the human soul would not necessarily reincarnate into the animal kingdom, the substance, the lives, the intelligence that we use, if given the wrong impress, will so-called transmigrate and be picked up by the animal kingdom around us, which creates much of the disharmonies in that kingdom. Okay.
Judge says that after fourth and a half rounds, no new souls will be incarnating into this earth, with one exception, he says, being the ape-like species. What is that going to be, and what is that going to be? Are we going to be seeing some kind of a new genetic mutation, or what are we going to be living alongside of?
Yourself.
We always have been.
She does speak about, Madame Blavatsky speaks about that. Again, it's the souls that have gotten entrapped in, you might say, crossbred forms, so that there is a delay and a lag in regards to when they will incarnate into the human form to begin to express their human qualities that were put on hold because of the poor decisions that we made. So it's not necessarily that there's going to be this brouhaha surprise, we're here. I mean, it's happening already. The lack of souls coming into the human kingdom is one thing in terms of kingdoms in general. But for the ones that are trapped, that are making those transitions, and she speaks about it again in the Secret Doctrine, how they will be moving from the animal form that they're entrapped in, those transitional gorillas, so to speak, if you will, into the astral nature of the human being, eventually into the position of a human being. So that's a gradual process. It's been happening. We're talking about millions of years. It's happening very, very slowly.
Are you referring to been happening like in Somalia, you know, where they're chopping each other up? Or give an example of it happening on Earth. I think I lost you there.
Well, then let's ask the question. What is it that truly takes on form after form? What is it that truly awakens the spiritual potential? What is
it? The Buddhic aspect of yourself.
Okay, so we're talking about the spiritual soul as the monad.
Yes.
The monad is that central spiritual element that organizes about itself, so to speak, matter, in one shape, form, or another, to work through senses to engage the world and learn. So if the monads that were trapped in those forms are now moving through the astral realm of our being, they're still moving in, they're still moving up, they're still in their own evolutionary stage.
How do you know they're moving into the astral form? Do you see them? And where do you see examples of that?
We can just say that the transition that was spoken of is not something that's going to happen for millions of years. We are not at that point. But we can look at those species, the orangutan, the chimpanzee, the gorilla, and we can sense there that there is an intelligence that is human in terms of their feeling, their social nature, their use of language, and some can even sense it in the intelligence that seems to be in their eyes. But what happens over time, and this is more to the point there, that unlike the human infant, where the vehicle we have allows for a greater human expression, in those species the human element is clouded over and obscured more and more by the animal nature as the species grows up. So we see that. That's what we see now. We have not witnessed yet their liberation.
I'll come back to that in a minute.
Just with respect to this, you know, since we're trying to be practical here, anybody who has any question about this, YouTube Coco the Gorilla. Mm-hmm. And this gorilla carries on conversations ad infinitum about any subject you want to listen to. And it's amazing. She uses American Sign Language. It will blow your mind.
And on that note, again, there's a difference between the astral form that a spiritual entity is using versus the encasement that you find them in. So just because you see what looks like a gorilla form does not mean necessarily when you're looking at the intelligence in transitional form that it's a gorilla monad, whatever that might be.
Yes.
I forgot my thought.
We'll come back to it.
Okay? Please.
Okay. Just raise your hand again.
Okay. Oh, I know what it is. The fact that we are told in the philosophy that as human beings, we either elevate life or degrade it. Yeah. And in hopes of elevating it, it would seem that eating meat would be a duty, that we, through our consumption of it, we are raising that animal up because we're incorporating it into the human kingdom as food, as building cells and building bodies.
But to that statement, HBB has one too. Eating meat, she says, is the tyrant's plea for food. It's not my words, in quotation marks. And she says before you can eat it, you have to kill it. And they're not here for us to kill it. And not only that, it is not about eating animal meat or vegetarianism at hand here, because it's a choice. And only when the neophyte is in line for occult training, is he then asked never to eat animal substance. And the reason being is that the animal also transfers its psychic ability to the eater of the meat. And that during that period, the neophyte is not allowed any association with any animal, pet or otherwise. And she says that in itself ought to teach us something, that their psychic nature definitely affects us as we affect them in return. But in our case, it's reversion. We go backwards to our animal nature. It is not uplifting the animal. It works the other way around.
And can I just add, and there may be some that are familiar with that article, the Elixir of Life in 5 Years of Theosophy, but if we are living our lives correctly and we are becoming less preoccupied with flesh and more preoccupied perhaps with the very feels and vibration of our nature, we begin to function from that perspective even more. So to engage when we're thinking about something like the Buddha being in the forest and none of the animals hurting, to resonate with our nature at a certain pitch implies that once again, we are awakening within the animals themselves the qualities and the principles that we throw out from ourselves and putting them as far as possible in their world in a different state, working from different principles and thereby raising their lives.
And if I may please make a comment, in every article that the student read for this preparation, it is stated that responsible killing of the animals causes them no pain. But this student also saw, if I may be permitted to give the title, Food Inc. Mm-hmm. And I recommend that you all do so because it's an eye-opener as to how our food is produced and the suffering of the animals. Mm-hmm. In this case, it was chickens for mass production. They are fed so much food in such a short period of time that their weight is so heavy their feet cannot carry it and they die. It is such an irresponsible way of producing meat. And the companies are saying, well, if you want responsibly raised animals, then tell us about it. So they're putting the responsibility back on us, back on the consumer. But most of the consumers do not know that the animal kingdom suffers tremendously at our hands because they have no say in it. It's not about eating meat or not eating it. It's about responsibility towards those lives that we use. We need to be beneficent to them and not inflict pain upon them. So please make that known to your congressman or however that works.
Well, thank you on that. And we think from all your comments that we've seen today that suffering's not something that we can completely eliminate from our lives, but we certainly can try to keep it as minimal as possible, and especially the unnecessary suffering. So we're at the end of our Interlodge Symposium on moral decisions, and we think we can all realize that it took a moral decision to be here, to travel from some distances on such a lovely day, but more importantly, it's going to require a moral decision on our part with what we're going to do with the benefit of all this shared experience and communication. Perhaps if one presentation or one idea was mentioned that resonates with you and begins to make a difference in the ethics of your everyday life, we can say that this was a very successful symposium, and we wish you well and a safe journey to wherever you may go. Our meeting is
thank you.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. Yeah. I have surgery. Oh. My eyes. That's why
I'm swollen. Hey, I got this cataracts knocked out of mine.
Unless you're clairvoyant, I don't believe you know whether I was one of the.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Gene.
Gene, don't leave yet. I want to talk.
Oh, yes.